Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 31st, 2014, and welcome to episode 82 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way back to
Oz? The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Earl Evans, and I'll be your pilot today, so make sure your items are stowed and that your seat backs are in their upright and locked position. We'll be flying at an altitude of, what, guys, 100 megabits?
At least.
Today, we've got a special treat. Our itinerant, often not here, but here today, host, Dr. Stephen Weyrich, is with us.
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Did I pronounce your name right?
Weyrich.
Why do I always pronounce it backwards?
Because it's a weird name.
It's not a weird name. I'm just a weird guy. I can't. So it's Weyrich.
Yes.
So from now on, I'm going to ask myself why I can't remember how to pronounce it. And that.
There you go.
Memory tricks. When you get to be my age, you got to use some of that stuff.
That's right.
Also, we have with us Paul Hagstrom, live and multimedia.
Yes. Yes. Hello.
How you doing, Paul?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It's I'm in Boston. It's a very big, you know, university and college town, and September 1st is the move date for everybody. Everyone switches apartments, so the streets are full of moving trucks.
Ooh, and yeah. School's about to start. So what's that mean for you? That mean your schedule gets a lot busier?
Actually, not this year. This year I'm not teaching this whole entire year. So what I get to do is sort of point and laugh.
I see. That sounds fun. I want to do that.
Not bad, yeah.
Sometimes you can do that in IT support, right? So who else we got on the call here? Speaking of an IT guy, Michael, how are you doing from the world down under?
The world down under is pretty good. I'm sore and aching from getting stuck into some gardening on my new acreage.
Yes.
Weeding is on a somewhat larger scale.
You were mentioning that. It sounds kind of like industrial strength weeding, not the weeding you might do with a weed whacker.
Definitely not. No, some rubbish stuff that's sort of blocking our view down to the creek. So any introduced species of trees and bushes, their days are numbered, so that we can just concentrate on the wonderful natural view.
Indeed. I have a house on a hill. It's in a housing complex where they built it on a hill, which was a little bit tricky, but made for some very nice views, except that the tree behind my house has decided to grow as trees do. And now the view out the window here in the gadget room is just a big tree and not downhill. So I have to decide what I want to do about that. Probably there is nothing I can do about that.
Chop it down.
No, this is Portland.
We have a similar thing as well, tree preservation orders, but there are species that you're allowed to eliminate. I shall be doing everything to the letter of the law.
It could be just thinning this one a little bit would help.
Have a look at the guidelines for pruning and how far you can go with pruning.
Yes. I mean, I really do actually love this tree. It's a beautiful tree out my back window. It's just very big. taking up all my space, but I digress.
Yeah, we just chop it up into 8 bits.
That's a good idea. Or, you know, make it 5 1/4. That's what I'll do. For the moment, though, I think I'll talk about retro computing, because that's...
I like that.
That's what we're gathered here to do. Now, if the show should end early, or if, you know, for some reason you have to turn up the volume a little bit and you're wondering, why is the show a little less boisterous than it normally is? It's because our co-host Carrington seems to be absentee, and in fact, he's AWOL. He didn't tell us he wasn't going to be here today. He just no-showed. But I think I know what it's all about. He was going to be at a fan expo, a wondrous nerdy event that he was really looking forward to. So I think that that's what happened. I think he got sucked into the sci-fi vortex.
Most likely that is true, yes.
So in his absence, we won't be able to benefit from his insight, but still we soldier on talking about the milestones of 1982. If you've been tuned into the last couple RCRs, then you know we've decided to dedicate our episodes that are in the 80s to the years in the 80s, because a lot went on in the computing world in the 80s. And I've got a few things to mention here, some of which provided... Bye, Dr. Steve. Thank you very much from your chronology. You are our resident published historian.
Yes.
So
I grabbed what I could find that looked like it was appropriate.
Well, one of the first interesting things is Intel announces the 80286 processor. So that seems like kind of the black sheep of the x86 family. Bill Gates famously called it brain dead, and it had some advantages over an 8088, but, you know, not a ton. It had the IBM AT, which did okay, but not great. So what do you guys think about the 286? How much of a landmark was that in the x86 legacy?
Well, it was the next step along in the long and slippery slope of Intel becoming effectively the chip CPU manufacturer du jour.
That's true. It kept their forward momentum going.
Mm. But apart from that, I don't really ever remember using a 286 system. So most of my Intel world started with the 386. So that's a little bit further along. But
I remember using the IBM PC right at that juncture. So I sort of think of the 286 in sort of fondly, because that was the fast machine used that, you know, like if my coworker was not using the AT, I could use it. I think of it fondly, but I don't really have a context for it. Except my own personal context, you know, that I thought of it as, you know, much superior to having to use the XT.
We kind of made a jump in the aerospace company I was working at. We had some IBM ATs, but not many. It turned out we kind of leapt straight from the PC XT to some of the 386 machines, starting with the PS2 Model 80, then the Model 70, and then moving on into the clones. I personally had a clone 286 machine at home, but if there were additional features in the 286, which there were, I didn't use them. It wound up being kind of like what you're talking about, Paul. It was a fast PC. It wasn't, I mean, it had the capability to have more memory, and I think the chip had some other things, but just never used them. It's just, this is a PC that does things faster than the PC XT.
Well, one of the references I've got mentions that it had this page suggests that it was a major step up, providing a lot of improvements in performance over the 88 and 8086, double or more performance at the same clock speed. And like you said, it lets you get more memory. I didn't have any personal computers of my own that used these things, so I guess I don't have any personal experience with it, but 82 is when it came out.
Yep. So other things that happened in 82, kind of a big step for Commodore, they released the Commodore 64. And this was famously the best-selling single model computer of all time, and also just made wads of cash for Commodore. It also made wads of cash for me because the profit margin on the Commodore 64 from the store, you know, from the official reseller point of view, was pretty high. When the things came out, they were $595, which bested any of the competition by quite a bit. But even though they were that cheap, there was still a huge difference between that $595 and what we actually paid for them to get them in the store. So somehow Commodore figured out how to make things very, very cheaply. I'm kind of sitting here talking with a bunch of Apple guys, but aside from any snide remarks, what comments might you have on that particular item?
Well, I was just noticing on the reference that you wrote 64K RAM and 20K of ROM, so they did some bank switching to manage all that?
They did. That 6410 processor that they used, one of the advantages Commodore had, of course, was that they owned MOS Technology, the company that made the 6502 and subsequent chips. So when they wanted some custom silicon, they could make it. And they made the 6510, which had some bank switching. So the Commodore 64 really did have 64K of RAM. And if you wanted to, if you were writing a machine language program, you didn't want the basic interpreter, for instance, you could just swap that out. And that would become RAM space instead. You could even do that with the kernel if you wanted to, although a lot of the kernel routines were handy, but you didn't have to have that either. You just swap it out.
That'd be like how Apple buys bits and pieces off Samsung today, and Apple still have the better computer.
So it's true that Atari and Apple, and I think wasn't the BBC Micro a 6502-based machine? So there were quite a few companies that had to come to Commodore's doorstep to get their chips. So
I just find it amazing that so many machines – were using the 6502, and Commodore was right in there with them, and as you said, selling those chips through MOS Technologies. It's just an interesting time, very much unlike what we have today.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it must have been the price of the processor was still made it advantageous to make a computer with that instead of the Intel or Motorola ones at the time.
Oh, it was. They still sold them cheap. Yeah, the 6502 was always cost competitive. Some other things that happened in 82. Here's a big one. Scott McNeely, Bill Joy, and friends founded Sun Microsystems, which had wide-ranging implications, I think, for the computer world. Any comments on that one?
I never, I'm only speaking up to say, no, not really. I never actually had... I don't think I had any opportunity to use any Suns. I'm sort of aware of them on the periphery of my life.
Well, I had the opportunity working for an internetworking company because the Sun machines were really good at doing things way down in the stack with networking. So if you wanted to test stuff, then they were really good machines for that. Also, when I worked for a company called Mentor Graphics, which was electronic design automation, Sun machines were big in that space as well.
And Sun workstations ran on Unix?
They did. Yes, they did. Solaris.
Yeah. The only time I was using Sun boxes was our high-end printers were using Sun workstations as I suppose a rip to translate the different print streams into the native imaging for the Xerox printers. So all the PostScript, the PCL, the IBM AFP, that was all being transformed on the fly by SunSpark workstations. Mm. So that wasn't until mid-90s. So.
And, of course, other things they introduced to the industry. Java is one. And then they had purchased there was some – I forget the exact sequence of events, but the OpenOffice suite had been involved with Sun at one point as well. So some other stuff, Sharp introduces the PC-1500 handheld personal computer, those little basic speaking handheld computers that are so cool. And I've got some of those in my collection. I guess I could say, using a pun, I have a handful of them.
But did you use any of those in the day yourself?
I didn't own one. I actually had an HP-41C back then, which didn't speak BASIC, but spoke its own programming language. But I did sell them, because I worked at a store where we had a lot of those cool gadgets, a store called Computique, which was a store chain in the Southern California area. And yeah, among the things that we sold were those BASIC speaking, kind of a mix between a calculator and a computer, really cool little things with, you know, outboard printers. And so here's a machine that I don't know very much about at all. Radio Shack in 82 introduced the TRS-80 Model 16, and it had a Motorola 68000 chip and a Z80 and an 8-inch disk drive. Has anyone in this crew ever used one of those suckers? I've seen pictures.
I saw it at the store, but never used one.
Ah.
Yeah, I had only heard about this, really, because it showed up in the show notes and I went to look it up. It's interesting to have this combination of a 68000 and an 8-inch drive. They feel like they come from two different eras.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. That's really true. A machine that had 5 1/4 drives was the K-Pro 2, introduced, as it says here, to compete with the Osborne. If you looked at a K-Pro 2 and an Osborne next to, you know, side by side, the industrial design of the two machines could almost be more different. The Osborne had that rounded molded plastic case, and the K-Pro was made out of real metal, baby.
So not terribly portable?
Both of them were pretty heavy, as I recall. We sold both in that same aforementioned store that I was talking about. The Osborne, I thought, was really impressive when it came out because of all of the software that it shipped with. I mean, that was worth as much or more in some ways as the computer that you got with it.
Now, didn't that Osborne use like a 40-column screen that swapped left and right as you worked on it? Or it didn't really fit all 80 columns onto that little monitor?
It had 50-some columns, and it did. That first one did scroll left and right.
Yes, yes. Did that K-Pro do the same?
Now, the K-Pro was a full – was it a full 80-column?
I think it was, and definitely being luggables, that was about the closest geeks of the day came to having exercise was moving those things around.
Yes. I had one for a little while in my collection, but I couldn't get the floppy drives to work, so I sold it. But it was pretty hefty. Were you going to say, Paul?
Well, there's a funny picture of the what is the name of the magazine? Profiles. Profiles, I think, is the sort of K-Pro-specific magazine, and one of the early issues has a picture of someone roller skating with a K-Pro 2, which looks, you know, fairly amusing, but, you know, making the point that it's portable.
Well, you could roller skate with one, but it isn't something I would do.
You couldn't stop.
Yes, you could move forward.
Well, I saw some picture when the first Mac came out of somebody with the Macintosh in a case sitting on the back of their bicycle as they pedaled through somewhere, and I just can't imagine risking a computer like that on a bicycle.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
By the way, it's possible, but not a good idea.
I was going to add I think the K-Pro 2 is sort of like DBase 2 that we talked about before, that there wasn't a K-Pro 1. It just started with K-Pro 2.
Right. But I think eventually they came back around and made a K-Pro 1, oddly enough.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd have to go review my K-Pro history again, but I think that's true. Another company that came out with some personal computers, and it seems somewhat begrudgingly, was Digital Equipment Corp. They came out with the Pro 300, which was like a Honey, I Shrunk the PDP-11. The Rainbow 100, which could run MS-DOS and CPM, and also the DeckMate 2, which was based, oddly enough, on the PDP-8. So of those three, the Rainbow 100 is the only one that I ever saw. I really liked the look of it, but I think they got caught in the whole, you know, it's kind of compatible, but not really PC compatible. And also, if you go watch the video, there's a video that DEC produced on their history of creating their personal computers. And throughout the whole video, you kind of get the feeling like they just were obligated to do this. Like it wasn't something they were passionate about. It wasn't something that they really were on fire about. It's more like they just felt like, oh yeah, we got to do it. So if you guys ever happen to watch that video, let me know if you get that same impression, because that's what it seemed like to me. I'll try and find a link for it for the show notes.
Well, I think other than being successful with the with IBM being successful with the PC, I don't think there's any mainframe company that came out with a quote-unquote personal computer that really put their heart and soul into it. They were not probably looking at them as a valid use of their time. They make the money on the mainframes. That's where things really happen. These are just toys.
Yes. And I was watching a documentary recently on Ken Olson. I think the name of it is Digital Man, Digital World, or I might have that reversed. But in the documentary, they talked about when he was quoted as saying, personal computers, why would people want to have one in their home, that kind of thing. But in fact, his idea was that the computers that you would have in your home, that you would have a computer in your home, but it would connect up to servers on a global network. And in fact, that seems to be a very a good guess, because
it'll never catch on.
Yeah, in effect, that's what we have now with the cloud and all that. They were mentioning that in the documentary. But I should move on. Some other noteworthy things, quite noteworthy here in the States. We got a version of the ZX, or as you would say, I'm sure, Michael, the ZX81.
Is there any other way to say it?
We're crazy. We say Z. And we had a Timex Sinclair 1000. Noticed we didn't put any Z at all in that model number so that we could avoid all that. And it had 2K doubled RAM, which was, I don't know what you would do with all that RAM.
Hmm. Yeah, those are weird little machines. I wound up with a few of them. I can hardly imagine. I didn't use them in the day. I was kind of aware of them and thought it would be kind of neat, and they were cheap, but they're really pretty hard to use, I have to say. I think I've only gotten one out of like five of them to actually display something on the screen, and they have this interesting method of input where you just sort of hit one key to get an entire keyword,
the whole basic keyword, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which once you got good at it, you'd probably be thanking your lucky stars so that you didn't have to do your full typing on that keyboard.
Oh, it definitely wasn't a keyboard for a typist, but with all the shift special functions on it, was an interesting little machine. And I thought it was good that the Timex Sinclair version had 2K over the 1K. I could not think of what you could actually do with a whole K of RAM.
Well, if you wanted more K, then you should get a ZX Spectrum.
Mm. Now, that was a nice machine when it came out.
Very well regarded. Had that as it had that kind of spongy keyboard, right? But it wasn't a chiclet keyboard. And it wasn't a membrane keyboard. It didn't have those little spongy keys.
Not quite sure exactly the sort of keyboard it was, but you definitely could type on it. I never owned one, but I played on a 48K version. A friend of mine got that as his computer. But, it was a very, very interesting time with the different approaches for handling the color and the programming that's on it. Hence the name Spectrum for the color support on it. But
And in Europe and some of the Commonwealth countries, and that there's still a very active fan scene for the Spectrum.
Yes. Oh, very, very active.
Lots of stuff going on. I'm always reading about it. Another cool thing, Norton Utilities version 1 for DOS. So who hasn't used Norton Utilities to save their life or to save a file?
I definitely have. It was almost a standard tool suite that was that our tech support people would have back for those days. But what I thought was most interesting that I think while Peter Norton was authoring that and releasing it, I think it was the heyday of Norton Utilities, and in the later years when Semantica was that bought the name, and the tool set no longer really had the same power or the necessity for it after Semantic took over. But it was definitely the toolkit of choice to start with.
And I think Peter Norton was one of the first, I think, geek rock stars. If you remember the software and also some of the books where he's standing there with arms folded and that sort of stoic glaze.
Very iconic.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Looked trustworthy.
He did. It looked like I would trust my data to this man.
Or at least the recovery of it.
Right. Some other things that happened in 82, Steve Jobs appeared on the cover of Time magazine. This was in February. And also, if you've watched some of the movies or read the accounts, Apple gives Microsoft a prototype of the Macintosh to help in developing applications for it.
Their lasting regret.
A very, very interesting turning point in history, wouldn't we say?
But of course, at the time, it was essential because Microsoft was one of several companies they really needed to make applications for this thing when it came out. And if you remember, there's a video out there when they were starting to introduce it, where they had the software dating game with Bill Gates and a couple of the guys that were saying, "Hey, we're on board with the Macintosh. We're making software for it." And of course, that ultimately led to them getting a foothold in with Windows in the future.
Yeah, I just saw that video. I think it must have just recently been reposted, perhaps by you. Microsoft, Bill Gates had said something like Microsoft was intends to get about half of its profits from Macintosh sales.
And there's some other things in here. I think I'm going to skip them in the interest of time, but if you're interested in some more highlights of 1982, we will put these up in our show notes so that you can go down and see all of the wondrous things that happened in that particular year.
Can I just point one of them that I think is interesting for its uniqueness, and yeah. That is that that was the year that Franklin Computer came out with some clones of the Apple II. Apple sued them, and the first time it got to court, it got thrown out of court. But ultimately, this was where legal status for software being able to copyright and protect software actually appeared. So this is kind of the early origins of some of the DRM stuff having legal status that we're still dealing with today.
Interesting. Yeah. And also this concept of that would later be revisited with Compaq, with a clean room clone scenario versus I just copied your stuff.
Yes, exactly. That's why Laser Systems, who later came out with a clone of the Apple II, the Laser 128 and so on, they were able to get around the whole copyright thing because they did do a clean room version of the ROMs and made it compatible with the Apple II ROM.
Mm. Cool. And I think they hint at that whole same scenario in that Halt and Catch Fire series, which I haven't watched any more episodes of. I don't know if you guys have kept watching that.
I want to see it, but I missed the beginning, so I'm waiting for it to be available to start looking at on reruns.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, I made it through, and it's good. It's a it's a drama or whatever. People do. There are things that are not technically historically accurate or. And the thing I remember actually with respect to the clean room stuff is that there's some crazy things they do, in the apparent, sort of decoding of the ROM, which they could have just like run a little utility program to dump it out to a disk,
more fun to have LEDs.
Right. But I will keep watching it. It's kind of neat. Their message to Twitter upon that renewal was a string of binary digits, which, actually turned into ASCII HCF renewed.
Oh, nice. Nice. Well, on to another topic introduced by one of our listeners, Sal. Thank you for writing in. And he was curious. I'll just go ahead and read what was written in the email here. Hi, RCR Podcast. I'm writing to ask if you wouldn't mind including a segment in an upcoming episode to describe each of your retro rooms. I'm wondering how your rooms are laid out. I'm in the middle of a home renovation, so I'm looking for ideas. Do you keep all your gear out, nicely displayed and arranged on desks or tables, or do you keep things stored away and take them out as your heart desires? So, guys, what do you guys do? You know what? I'll start. I was lucky enough when we bought the house that we're in now that we got this tri-level. I mentioned it was on a hill. And so the bottom floor, there's a lot of square feet down here, and it's like a daylight basement. You know, part of the bottom floor actually faces out onto the hill, but the other part, you got windows and such, plenty of light. And initially when the kids were younger, they would use the downstairs to run around and be crazy. But as they've gotten older, there's been less and less of that. So my vintage computer collection has been encroaching. You know what? I figure if I sneak up on it, nobody will say anything. So I've got a table out where I keep two or three things on a rotation. Right now, it's the VT100 terminal and my Commodore 128. And also over in the corner is the PDP-11, which is the size of a small refrigerator. So that doesn't get swapped in and out. That pretty much stays put because I don't want to be rolling that thing all over the place. But the rest of the gear I keep, if it's small enough, in Rubbermaid containers stacked nicely in my closet or other places on shelves and that kind of thing. So I just, as the muse moves me, I swing things around and play with something or write some software or whatever. So let me go around the table. Let's start with you, Michael, because you're in the middle of building the ultimate nuclear-proof 8-bit joy room, are you not?
Well, the 8-bit bunker is my pride and joy. We've just moved out onto acreage, and it's a sandstone, cliffy area, and the house is on a lower level as you drive in off the road, and it's single, just a single story, and underneath at one end, it's been carved out of the sandstone for the concrete slab to go over the top. So downstairs is a room about 6 by 7 meters. I have to figure that out. What's that in feet? So
about 1 million.
Yeah. But yeah, so downstairs is carved back into the sandstone, so and then it's a double brick. So at the back, it's very cool, and at the front, where there's the sliding glass windows or doors, out looking out over the backyard down into the bush and the creek. So great aspect. So I'm having to make sure that one of my desks is oriented so I can look out on the view. But bookcases line two of the walls, and I also have three six-foot bookcases dividing the room into sort of like a bit of a storage area. So they're like freestanding. A couple of three-foot bookcases clustered together in islands. Two desks.
And how many books? Shelving. How many books did you say you have?
I can't remember how many feet.
Yeah, linear
feet storage. I think some getting close to 300 linear feet of bookshelves. So that's technical books, histories, and quite a lot of paperbacks. I do like a good read, and magazines as well. So quite a lot there. And one corner, I've set up an old CRT TV. You know, the chromey plastic and grey metallic laminated particle board, so for the display cabinet that it's in. So just trying to keep a bit of a retro feel with the TV that's downstairs. But the main thing is that I'm going to, like Earl, have a desk with one or two projects that are in action, and then the rest is basically just going to be on open shelving. It's not really set up as in a museum style. It's more, I suppose, back room is the decor. But the important thing is that it means that I can get my computers out of the main house and pretty much set up and use them the way that I want to. As opposed to how she who must be obeyed wants them set up.
So I was wondering, if you're going to have a CRT television, are you going to have yourself a VCR to use with it?
Well, probably one of the VCRs will go downstairs, but I think that's more just to for show rather than for use. I'm more of a digital recorder person myself. I have a couple of small PCs and Macs that have got USB TV tuners, but a tape deck, and there's my LP player will be down there as well. So
nice.
Yeah, so we'll have 80s music played off the vinyl.
Perfect. What about you, Steve? What's your retro PC environment like?
Well, I have about, I think, eight old computers here. Three old Macs, about three different Apple IIs, and I've got maybe four Macs. So I've just got a display case that has some cubbies that are about, 2 foot by 2 foot, enough to put one computer in each one, and then I'm putting some books in the other spaces. And most of the rest of the books and printed stuff I have is in file cabinets or in Tupperware tubs to keep it all in one place. Most of my collection is information rather than things, but I still have my old software for my Apple II and 2GS, and I've got it now on a flash card instead of on a hard drive for the Apple IIs. But that's my arrangement. Nothing terribly fancy. It's stuff I just don't want to throw out, or things that I have rescued and wanted to keep for sure. And so I now have a place to display it.
Well, it makes sense with your particular inclination toward history and documentation that you would have a lot of paperwork in your collection.
Yes, yes. I kind of file drawers full of it.
Gotcha. Paul, why don't you close us out here? What's your situation like?
It is not a model for anybody, I would say. No one should aspire to where I am now, but I have a sort of aspirational goal. And I have a fairly large office. I work in academia, and so I have a sort of a professor's office, and it has sort of been slowly, disappearing under piles of old computing equipment, and it's about 150% full right now. So I'm working on that to scale everything back and so forth. But I do have a lot of shelf space in this kind of an office, and so I have a sort of a nice big table that could be used as a workspace, although I intend mostly to have things on shelves kind of accessible so that I can pull them down. I have a lot of these portable ones. I think the ones that are sort of fixed, like I have some, like, an original Mac and a Mac Cube and IBM PC and so forth. I would like to have them work in place so that I can I can just pull up a sufficiently high chair to it and just turn it on and use it. I want it to be sort of a combination display and use, and I sort of have enough wall space to do that. Most of my sort of software and books and that kind of stuff are arranged in file cabinets. I have big visions, and maybe, at the end of that year of not teaching, I will have organized it.
Excellent. And you do have quite the collection, from the fairly common to the esoteric. So organizing it, I could see, might be a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, I've been keeping relatively good track of things as they come in, but there's still kind of a lot of cross categorization that I do in my kind of internal data management, and so it has happened more than once that I've wound up seeing something on eBay, getting it, like being excited to see it, and then realizing that, I can now put this one next to the other one that I already had because I forgot that I had gotten it already. So that's another goal, is to just try to figure out what everything is.
Gotcha. Well, one more thing before we leave listener feedback. I think, Michael, you might have put this in. Max notes, we missed the Osborne 1 as happening in 1981, and we didn't talk about it last time. But I guess we kind of made up for that by talking about it this time in 1982. But just a note, that's something else that happened. And so 2 weeks ago, we should have said that. We didn't, but now we are. And having corrected that oversight, why don't I go ahead and give you the floor, Michael? It looks like you've got our first news item.
Okay. Well, it was more of an announcement. So here in Australia, we have a IRC every Friday night for the Apple II, for the Apple II Oz group that I'm in. And last Friday, Bill Martin from Call APPLE and Andrew Rowan made an announcement that the complete Australian Apple Review magazine has been completed scanning and fully OCR'd, and the PDFs are now available for download. So fairly important magazine in the Australian computing magazine sense. It was created and published by Gareth Powell, fairly well-known publisher in IT computing from the 80s. And we'll include a link both to the announcement blog on Call Apple and also a link to the applearchives.com. So all of you folks who aren't in Australia, you might like to pop over to this link and have a look at one of our magazines from the 80s. So there's four volumes, and all issues from those volumes are available for your perusal.
Did you have other Apple-related magazines that were sold in the 80s?
Not that I can remember, and I must admit that I was aware of this magazine, but I didn't actually subscribe to it myself. I was already purchasing the Nibble magazine and a few other titles, so mainly out of the UK and the US. But we did also have Australian Personal Computer, which was a, although it was, I suppose, by accident, more along the lines of the PC side of things, but it did also cover non-IBM compatible things in its earlier days. But I must admit, I suppose was a bit more not in my backyard. I thought, well, I'm interested in Apple computers. I'm going to get my magazines on that from the US. And then also you've got the Sinclair range. So, you know, I was getting the occasional magazine out of the UK and not really spending much of my money on Australian magazines. But it's been great to go back and have a read.
Well, I was glad to see this become available, and I did get to see the first year or two of it from a membership with Call Apple when it, part of it was available, and I used that for one of the foreign magazine chapters in my book, just to say, hey, there's something here in Australia that was about the Apple II, and they had some good articles.
Yeah, the important thing is that they were able to track down all the issues. No one person had them all. Even the National Library of Australia didn't have a complete collection, but between quite a few people and the National Library, all of those have now been scanned and, more importantly, are available in a PDF OCR version. So a great resource, not just for Australian computer users wanting to look back in the day, but there are articles in there that basically are useful to whoever, wherever, of course, for an Apple bent, but still, it'd be great to get hold of other non-Apple club magazines and newsletters from here in Australia and get those scanned and available. So if anyone out there has a collection of user group newsletters or magazines, maybe it's time to get those scanned and available for other people to have a look at.
And I think one of the important things about this, too, is that they didn't just take them all and scan them and put them on the Internet without regard to who owned the copyright. They actually got permission from Gareth Powell to put all this stuff up.
Yes, that's the best part about it all. So not only taking the time out to get that permission, but a big thanks to Gareth for actually giving that approval for them to be scanned and presented in their entirety and put up there on the Internet for everyone to have a read.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to looking at these. I've kind of enjoyed going back over my old, you know, Soft Talk issues and Apple Orchard issues and things that I read at the time. But what's kind of neat about this is it's like a new magazine, you know, like I haven't read these and yet it's all, you know, it's all sort of like stuff that's in the same universe that I know pretty well. So I'm kind of looking forward to pretending that I'm subscribed to it.
Well, you will find some new stuff in there because it did actually, being Australian magazine, it reviewed software that had actually been written and distributed in Australia and not necessarily distributed that widely outside of Australia. So I believe I was reading a article on different types of word processors, so that you've got, for the Apple world, there was the Sandy's text editor, Zadax word processor. So that there's lots of software and things that has an Australian bent or to it. So there will be something new for people to read in there if you're not necessarily from Australia.
Right.
Very cool. I love those kind of archival efforts. And I'm looking forward to reading those as well, because it's always interesting to me to get the what was happening somewhere that I wasn't kind of viewpoint. So next up, I've got something here, just a very brief. MES, the multi-emulator super system, is used to emulate a lot of retro computers, and the different modules for it strive for as close as they can get to chip level compatibility. And in a lot of cases, it's a work in progress, but it's still pretty cool. I was reading about some recent work on a obscure computer I'd never heard of, the NCR DecisionMate 5. I didn't know that there was a DecisionMate 1 through 4. But this computer was one of those, we were just talking about another one, the Rainbow, that was one of those hybrids kind of straddling the fence between the world of CPM and the world of MS-DOS. So this one could have both chips, a Z80 and an 8088. Interestingly, also a 68008. So this thing was trying to be everything. But a group of people have done some work on tuning up the emulation of this particular model in MES. And it reminded me, just in general, to be looking at MES for emulation of other CPM-based machines or just obscure machines in general. It's amazing what you can find that MES actually emulates. And Paul, I've been listening to the Drop 3 Inches podcast. Isn't it MES where the work was done recently on the Apple III to make that ready-to-run thing?
Yes, yeah. That was the thing that sort of just kind of got the... I don't know, it made it possible to even emulate an Apple III at all. It was there were no good emulators before that. But it's been interesting. I've been looking at the code base a bit, partly not so much for Apple III, but Apple II, very low level disk stuff. And it's very complex, but there's a very active community. Everybody's working on, you know, trying to get their, you know, the machine that they're focusing on to emulate, you know, be emulated perfectly. So it's very interesting. It's a very big, it's a large scale effort.
So MES is a focal point of a lot of this emulation activity, and of course, the JavaScript MES that Jason Scott and the team has been working on to make all of this, or as much as can work in a web browser, be available, so that you can just light up your web browser and emulate these old systems. It's just great stuff, and I wanted to point it out. And with that, I'll move on to the next thing, a punch card simulator. I have seen this online. This thing is awesome. Dr. Steve, do you want to talk about this one?
Yeah, this I guess cloth KLOTH.net has a punch card simulator in the sense that you can type something that would go on a punch card. You can choose which format you want it to be on, whether it's a DEC 029, IBM 029, or some older 026 or even EBCDIC formats. And you can see how that would look on a real punch card. You can make the output either be a PNG or a JPEG. And you put something on there, and I had put on Welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable and put that in the show notes there. And it just looks like those old punch cards from the mainframe days, which I thought just looked kind of cool.
It's so much fun. Those things are so much fun. I finally, after a lot of decades of never touching one, got to use a real key punch a couple weekends ago when I went up for that vintage computer fair at the Living Computer Museum.
And that
was a huge amount of fun. But, you know, you can only punch one or two cards there, whereas with a virtual thing like this, heck, you could make a whole card deck
if you wanted. Well, and I remember in the days of, in college in 75 using probably the 029 IBM key punch to do the cards for the Fortran class and having to go back and change a card and run it through again because you made a mistake. And it was just kind of cool seeing this again. Not that it was any easy, it's much less easy to use than what we had even with an Apple One, but still, it's still kind of cool.
I agree. And speaking of cool stuff, Paul, you've been playing around with something here that I've been seeing a lot of tweets about. What is this basic tokenization madness that you guys have been tweeting about?
Well, yeah, it was pretty strange. This is not exactly a news item so much as it's kind of like a report on what I was you know messing around with a couple of days ago. But it was sort of brought to my attention that there. It's kind of like a protection trick on Apple II where you can have an AppleSoft basic program, and the way it's organized in memory is, well, let me sort of back up a step. So in AppleSoft basic, which is where I started, although the path goes much further than this, any given line in a basic program has a sort of a set format where it starts off with a pointer to the next line in memory, and then the line number, and then this like special tokenized version of the basic line just to save memory. So you know, a print is one byte, and you know, let is another byte, and strings and variables get represented in longer strings. But the main thing is that every line starts with a pointer to the next line, so it's all this sort of forward chained thing. And so someone had observed that you know, on one of the protected disks on the Apple, there was a AppleSoft program you could load that actually sort of contained three different programs that kind of first moved the pointer to somewhere else, and then that middle program did some kind of protection check, and then it moved the pointer to somewhere else, and then the main program was running. So I was playing around with this a little bit, and was essentially trying to I made a three-line program where the first normally the first line would point to the second point to the third. And so what I did was I just sort of poked in a value to make the first one point to the third. And so you list it and you see the first line and the third line and nothing else. But when you run it, all three run. And it's really, it looks insane, you know, because there's a hidden line that's not doing anything. It's you can't see it in the list, but it actually functions. So I tweeted this, said, this is crazy, you know, and someone tweeted back and said, you know, actually, that works on the Commodore 64, too. Exact same thing, exact same poke. And it turns out this is, of course, because Microsoft provided the BASIC for everybody, and they used the same tokenization, the same forward chaining system. So tried it out on the Commodore 64 works exactly the same. The PET works basically the same, except in a different, the BASIC space is a different space. VIC-20 is the same, except yet a different space. I got it working on the IBM 5150. So all of these, you can make this. It's almost like a bug that's massively cross-platform. You know, you can have a program that will not show you a line, but will still execute it. Very, very interesting. So I was kind of what I thought was kind of neat about it was just it felt like it really showed how far Microsoft's reach was.
Interesting. So on all of these, since they had the Microsoft BASIC, what you're doing is essentially playing with the linked list and just repointing something on the linked list. But the thing that surprises me, though, is that when you run the program, even though you've messed with the linked list of BASIC statements, all of the BASIC statements still run.
Yeah, yeah. It does seem like that's a bug of a sort. But what's cool about it is that it works in, you know, many, many different 8-bit, you know, eight bit computers.
Very nice. Will you have a link to these tweets up in the show notes? Can we put these in the
Sure.
So people can see? Yeah.
They're just screenshots of emulators, you know, all showing basically the exact same program, listing what two lines and running three.
And I think the Atari 8-bit machines didn't get their BASIC from Microsoft, right? They had a Microsoft BASIC that was available for them if you wanted to buy it, but otherwise the BASIC programming cartridge, I think, was their own version.
Yeah.
It's a shame our Atari expert's not with us today.
Yes, that's right. our new fledgling Atari 800 expert, yes.
Right.
Yes, indeed.
I did look a little bit into the Atari 8-bit BASIC just to see if I could make something similar, even if it wasn't actually Microsoft. But and it's hard, actually. It's there's something I don't understand. It does a similar kind of linked list thing, but instead on each line it has sort of two forward links. One says, you know, this is the end of the statement, and then this is the end of the line, and that's to allow you to put several statements on a single line. But no matter what I did with those pointers, I just ended up getting garbage between those two lines. So Atari has somehow, you know, avoided the bug by just, you know, giving you garbage if you mess with it.
Well, I think it's a different interpreter implementation.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yep. So onward, Michael, Xerox PARC. I saw recently a video with Larry Tesler talking about Steve Jobs' visit and that. What happened here?
Well, again, it's an old video, so the video is what they call an eyewitness account of the closest thing in computing history to a Prometheus myth. So everyone that I come into and they find out that I like Apple computers, and the first thing they say is, oh, Steve Jobs stole that from Xerox. And it's interesting how pervasive that myth actually is. And it never really happened. So in this video, we'll have a link to both the Fortune magazine's entry on it, and then you can go to the YouTube video from there. But this excerpt is from the full 100 minutes discussion panel. So if you got the time, you can watch that as well. But basically, it's Larry Tesler's account of when Steve Jobs came through the demo room where he was on the day. And he's basically saying, Jobs spent a lot of time pacing the room. On one occasion, he brings things to a halt. Stop, 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 stop. Just stop this discussion. We need to tell them about the Lisa. So... and then, what's going on here? You're sitting on a gold mine. Why aren't you doing something with this technology? You could change the world. And that's Steve Jobs talking to the Xerox guys. So it's quite a different bent, as I said, on the myth of Apple stole it all from Xerox. And Tesla, again, makes it clear that Xerox approached Apple, hoping to build a partnership out of it. And basically, the fee was they got $1 million worth of Apple stock at bargain prices.
Before the stock was available.
Yes. And Steve required a disclosure about everything cool. Now, I'd love to see a disclosure statement that says, tell me everything that's cool.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, it's great to get these firsthand accounts up onto the web so that other people can find out about things that they perhaps didn't quite understand or had been holding onto the wrong end of the stick all this time. So For people out there who are still in the Apple stole it all camp, time to pop over and have a look at what someone who was actually working at Park was got to say about it. But nonetheless, a very interesting video. And as I said, if you've got the time, I haven't watched the full 100 minutes of the full video, but I've skipped through it, and it's on my to-watch list.
Now, one of the things I found interesting is I got done reading the Dealers of Lightning book somewhere in the last 6 months. It talks about Xerox PARC and the formation of it, what it did and stuff like that. And it does have a chapter that deals with the famous Steve Jobs visit. And in that chapter, they said the problem with that visit is that there are, you know, maybe half a dozen different accounts about what happened, how it went down on that thing. And these are all from people that actually were there. So there are strong opinions out there about, obviously, Steve Jobs. He never elicited mild opinions, but there's strong opinions out there about how it happened, what had happened, who said what, when did it occur. And apparently there's no one agreed upon story that everybody goes with. And the book itself specifically says this is hard to write about because everybody remembers it differently.
It's probably how physically close they were to Steve Jobs because of the reality distortion field.
Possible, yes.
Some of their realities were warped in a different way than others. And I think the one thing that's fairly universally agreed on is that Xerox's intellectual property was not misappropriated.
That's correct. They did have permission to use it and to make a product using it too.
Right. So the whole Apple stole it from Xerox, we can put that myth to rest right now, and we're not even Mythbusters.
Exactly.
One of the things that was sort of interesting about the video, and maybe this has something to do with why there are no two accounts alike, is that at least in the Larry Tesler discussion, there were several visits. You know, it seemed like there were at least two or three that were discussed as, you know, taking place with different people and different configurations. So it could be that had something to do with why people remember different things.
Interesting. Well, I watched some of that video and I really liked it. And like Michael, I want to get back and watch the whole thing. And also on videos, if you get done with that video and you're hungry for more, just a month ago, the 10th Convex was held in Las Vegas. This is the Commodore Vegas Expo. And apparently with Commodore, what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas because there are some videos that are making their way to the internets. So I've got a link here that I'll put up in the show notes. Among the highlights are screencasting on a Commodore 64. My buddy Greg here in town is actually one of the pioneers of this. I've seen this in action. One Commodore 64 viewing what's going on another Commodore 64, almost a la PC Anywhere sort of thing. It's really cool. Also, there was a presentation on a device called Myst, which is a FPGA hardware device that can emulate classic Amiga, Atari ST, Commodore 64, and other stuff. Lots of work these days with FPGAs and putting cores in them that emulate old computers, and they can do it down at a hardware level, so it's really neat. Another thing, and this might particularly interest you, Paul, was using the SuperCard Pro to make archives of old 5 1/4 and 3 1/2 floppy disk. Apparently, this is another one of those flux-level disk archive tools, although I haven't read a lot about it. Are you familiar with that card?
I have read a little bit about it. I'm not completely clear on you know, to what extent, except I guess for the fact that it is sort of under a little bit more current focus and development than the Disk Ferret. I'm not sure exactly why one, you know, given that I already have a Disk Ferret, if I would need a SuperCard Pro, but it looks very tempting. You know, certainly if I didn't already have one, that would be in my sights.
Gotcha. Well, and there's more videos too. So if you're in a mood for some videos, just go on over to c128.com at the link that we'll have in the show notes, and you can dial in. And then I think, let me scroll down a bit in the show notes here. Oh, we got a couple more things coming up. Paul, what have you got about the spectrogram?
Okay, well, so this is actually quite a lot of video being discussed on this audio podcast, but someone had tweeted a link to a YouTube video where somebody basically took the handshake sound for a dial-up modem. I didn't quite recognize what it was. It might be 56. I don't know. Anyway, it's, you know, one of the, I think of it as a kind of a more recent modem, but it's basically a graph of the different sound frequencies animated over time. And so you can sort of, you can listen to this familiar sound of the dial-up connecting, and then you can watch the graphics go. And it's strangely fascinating. You know, I mean, it's a very familiar sound, but being able to see all those little pieces that you can hear is really quite something. So anyway, I recommend going to watch the video. It's particularly if you are, you know, if you still have that modem connection sound playing in your head.
Definitely. I do now.
Yep. But to see what those sounds are made of, it's really quite. I was not expecting to be so amazed by it as I seem to have been.
Nice. Well, it seems like you say, we have a lot of video to go watch. This is good entertainment. Dr. Steve, why don't you close us out on the news? What have you got here about AT&T's You Will ad campaign?
Well, it's this apparently comes up from time to time on the internet. I found mentioned in 2009, 2011, but it showed up on the Retro Computing Group on Google Plus, and I had remembered, speaking of this, another video. There was a series of commercials that AT&T did in 93 and 94 talking about apparently their visions of what future technology would be, and I would love to know what was going on at AT&T in their marketing group, where they said, hey, let's do these cool videos, if this is stuff that they were actually researching to figure out how to do, or if somebody just wanted to be forward-thinking and say, well, could we do this? What if we did this? It was a series of commercials. It was directed by David Fincher, and I was surprised to find that this guy has later done major videos, The Curious Case, major movies. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, The Social Network, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, there are movies that he's done recently. And then Tom Selleck narrated these. And it showed each commercial, which they have a link on YouTube from the BuzzFeed link that's on here, shows basically all the commercials. They show about three scenarios in each commercial where they say, have you ever done this kind of a thing? And at the end, they say, well, you will, and the company that will bring it to you is AT&T. And they had borrowing a book from a library thousands of miles away, and this showed somebody on a video screen looking at somebody turning pages on a book. Obviously, we have a better way of doing that now. Crossing the country without asking for directions, kind of presaging using GPS and online maps. Ever paid a toll without slowing down? I don't even live in a city that has toll things like that. But when I drove through one once, I saw that, yep, they just have a thing that lets you pay the toll as you run through there. Sending a fax from the beach, wireless communications, video phones. They've been trying to get video phones working since the days of the Jetsons on TV. you know, they talk about some things involving like video conferencing and video on demand and checking out a supermarket, a whole cart at a time. We're not quite there yet, but it's just amazing how many things 20 plus years ago, well, about 20 years ago, they said, here's what we think the future is going to be like. And even though it did, for the most part, come, AT&T really, other than maybe helping provide some of the bandwidth for it, didn't have a whole lot to do with bringing it to us.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I mean, some of the work that they did in Bell Labs, even as far back as the 60s and 70s, formed the foundation for some of those technologies, like the development of Unix and the C programming language and that kind of thing. But when it came down to actually having that stuff today, we don't even really think of AT&T in that context, do we?
Huh. No. And it's funny. I mean, some of the, then they show the guy on the beach doing his fax and sending it. It looks he's using something that looks a lot like a Newton, and it wasn't a Newton, but the screen was very similar to that. Size and form factor was much like it, but it was an early stylus-based tablet, so to speak, that he's using to create and send this fax. Although we wouldn't be faxing today, we'd simply be emailing or directly communicating. Have you ever gotten a phone call on your wrist? Well, we haven't got the iWatch just yet. Maybe next week. But you know, all these, and actually, it's just when I watched it, it was just very it was 20 years ago. It's a retro moment looking at these commercials. I remember seeing these commercials on TV, and I just thought they were kind of cool at the time. And it's how many of these things we have now.
I remember the commercials too. I only saw one or two of them back in the day, but it was fascinating. It was always fun to dream.
Well, it's only about a 6-minute watch to look through the supposedly the whole collection of all of them is proposed on the YouTube site. Now, there's a couple more out there that never got included in the collection. I don't know, but it's not very long to watch it. But it is just interesting when you see them envisioning the future 20 years ago.
And as my wife and I observed from time to time, the future arrived. We weren't paying attention, and all of a sudden it snuck up on us. Very cool.
Software City is proud to present the Leading Edge Model D. The Model D provides you with the perfect system to match your needs. Start with the Selectric style keyboard, then add a dual floppy disk drive or a 30-megabyte hard disk drive. Top it all off with a high-resolution monochrome monitor or RGB color monitor. Complete system started only $12.95. That saves you up to thousands of dollars of the price of IBM or other compatible systems. The Leading Edge Model D, available at Software City in Parkway City Mall and their new store in the Gallery on University Drive.
Well, now's the time in the show where we talk about what you can buy that favorite geek or retro enthusiast in your life. And the last few times, it seems like I've fallen back on either clothing or fashion accessories or some sort of a doodad like that. So in this case, I decided to go a little bit more techie. The retro computing gift idea this time is a Micromite. Now, this is not a tiny little synthetic bug that bites you. This is a 28-pin chip that has been programmed to speak a dialect of BASIC that is pretty darn close to the Microsoft BASIC dialect. And it's a dual inline plug, the DIP style chip, so you can plug it in your breadboard and or easily put it in one of your through-hole designs. And it's only $6. And there's a couple different projects that I've read about recently that are using these. And you could use it, in fact, as the basis of your own little homebrew retro-inspired computer, if you wanted to, as one of these projects does. So I thought it was a neat little gizmo. It's going to be definitely on my Christmas list. And I've got a link in the show notes to the page where you can get more information on this and also to a couple places where you can buy them, including one board that is being put together over at Propeller Powered called the Micromite Companion. And this combines the incredible, awesome supercomputing power of this Micromite chip and the parallax propeller to give you a computer that can literally fly you from here to the island of your choice. Actually, I don't think it can do all that, but it can do some cool stuff. So that is my gift idea.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm very tempted. And if it's Microsoft-like, maybe I can actually get this three-line, two-line program check to work.
That would be fun. If I get one of those before you do, Paul, I'll give you a ring.
Okay.
We'll see.
They'd have to give you the details of their memory map and where BASIC starts.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's have the fun finding it.
That's interesting. A little reverse engineering. And the fun continues in terms of what stuff you can buy because we've got our eBay segment. And we're going to start with our eBay expert, Paul. What have you got for us?
Okay, well, the one thing I have for you is a kind of ridiculous one, which is I'm only just sort of linking to this auction because it was sort of funny to see it, but someone has found an Atari 810, which is the disk drive label, and is selling the label. So if you have a an Atari 810 disk drive and don't have the label, this is this is the auction for you.
I have been waiting for one of these. I can't believe you found it. See, I told you you're our eBay expert.
The other one. So I'm a little surprised it's still here. But since it is, I will talk about it. It's so this is a it's kind of like a Radio Shack bundle. So it's got a Color Computer 2 in it, and it's got a lot of software that goes, some tapes that go with it, and the manuals that go with it, and I think there's a basic course in there. Little covers. It's got a printer, which is pretty cool.
And Model 100 also.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's the Model 100 is just sort of thrown in as well. So there's sort of two kind of interesting computers there. The printer, which I think is a little bit uncommon. I think Carrington was talking about that at some point in the recent past. It's kind of like a little thermal receipt printer almost. It's a little bit wider. And then there's an actual Radio Shack tape deck and the deluxe joysticks as well. And right now it's at a buy it now of basically $58, which so it's kind of a lot of money all at once, except when considering all of those things together, even individually, I think, these things would almost reach that. So I don't know why it hasn't sold. I've been very tempted, except that there's nothing. I don't have any place to put any of this stuff. So somebody should get it.
I agree. I think that price is very reasonable. If the Model 100 works, you could sell the Model 100 for almost the price of this whole auction.
That's true.
Nice. Michael, you're up next.
Yes, well, I've just recently bought a Dick Smith VZ300, so I was looking for other bits and pieces that would go with the VTech line of computers. So this one is a VTech Laser 1, a thermal printer. So this is original packing. Even comes with a roll of thermal paper. So if you like the smell of thermal paper in the morning, this one is for you. So I was tempted to get this one myself, but I've decided that I'll just stick to the computer itself rather than worrying about other peripherals. But it's good to see a printer in such good condition. So it doesn't look like it has actually been used to me. So
yeah, that is pretty pretty clean looking.
Very clean looking plastic, and the roll doesn't look dirtied.
Well, so what computers would this work with?
The VTech machines, which here in Australia were relabeled Dick Smith VZ300, VZ200. So
those would not be the ones that were Apple II compatible. This would be PC compatible.
These are the Z80 based ones. Oh, sorry, okay. I'll translate Z80.
Okay, I know what you're talking about.
But it's just something that came up in my search while I was looking for the actual VZ300.
Okay, great.
And Dr. Steve, I see that you've made a smooth segue here on your eBay auction pick.
Well, since we were doing 1982, I just happened to find two 1982-based auctions there on eBay. One of them is for since nobody knew or had used the TRS-80 Model 100, you can get a service manual there with this one auction. And I think they said that was for only $9, buy it now. So if you want to find out what you need to know about servicing this computer that you don't have, you can use that. I couldn't find one actually for sale. And then someone did have a Franklin Ace 1000, which is one that we didn't really touch on much, but they had the Franklin Ace 100, which was kind of Apple II Plus compatible, and then they upped it with the 1000 later in the year, which had more capacity, and they had one with one or two disk drives, 1100 and 1200 respectively, were their models. Well, this 1000 with no disk drives, you can get it for $75 by it now. Supposedly works.
And that seems like a really reasonable price to me, too. Although it seems to, is it missing a case badge, or is that just the photo?
I think the case badge has come off of that, yes.
But aside from that, that seems like a very reasonable price for one of the Franklins. You Apple, yes. Apple folks, tell me if I'm off base on that.
That seems pretty close. Yeah, I think you have to be a certain kind of collector or something in order to want one of these, because it is not Apple, but at the same time it sort of made an impact, you know. And I had a friend who had one of these, you know. I used one. I'm relatively familiar with them. And it is kind of weird having you know, this different shaped case do all the Apple II stuff inside.
And even though I said I didn't have much in my collection, if I could create my own collection and had space to put everything I wanted in there, I would want to have pretty much every model of Apple II that was out there, and maybe get one of those replica ones to have an Apple I. But then it would be cool to get a few of the well-known clones, you know, a Franklin, a Laser, maybe, you know, one of these, some of these other ones, a Bassus 108, these other ones that just you heard about back in the day, to show this is what people had to choose from back in that day, in that era.
I would love to have one of the 1000s, because it's the only clone that I had the opportunity to actually use and sell, as it turns out, because Apple was pretty selective about their dealerships back in the day. And so the dealership that I spent the most time working for wasn't actually an Apple authorized dealer. We didn't have Apple stuff, but we could get the Franklins. And so we did, and then all the legal problems happened, and then we didn't have them anymore, which is kind of a bummer. But yeah, it'd be cool to have one of those.
Oh, there you go. Only $75 with $31 shipping.
I know. And it could be mine.
Yes.
But actually, I got to tell you guys what I'd really like to have, which is my eBay auction here. It's a combination of several different things, all Digital Equipment Corp, and a couple of them really fascinating. One is called a PDT 11/150, which it turns out, if I'm reading it right, was another one of these I shrunk the PDP 11 sort of scenarios, with a couple of 8-inch. Are those 8? It looks like 8-inch disk drives there in the picture. Anyway, this was one of the PDP 11s that, as the Wikipedia page says, was not the standard bus, like Unibus or QBus or some of their standard expansion bus. This was a custom form factor. Also, another thing here is a VT62, which is a very peculiar looking kind of terminal device that I know almost nothing about, but it generated a lot of discussion over on the CC Tech mailing list.
I really like the keyboard too. It's a very pretty terminal.
It's colorful, isn't it?
Yes.
It's neat. Yeah. But the thing that just jumps right out at me on this auction is that deck writer, the standing dot matrix printing terminal. You know, if I had what I could define as a holy grail for my retro computer collection, this is it. I must have one of these someday. I love these terminals. I don't know what it is about them. It's just weird. I used them in college, and they look neat, or they look retro or something, but one of these days I got to have one of those. So,
and this could be connected to your PDP?
It could. And that's what we did back in college. We had that sucker hooked up to the PDP 11 Master Blaster in the computer room. So, yep. Now, of course, the fanfold paper is pretty expensive these days, especially if you get the green bar stuff. But, oh well. So this auction is my pick. It's $190, the current bid, for all three of these things. And the only downside is you got to be near Massachusetts, or have somebody who'd be willing to pick it up in Massachusetts and then ship it to you, because there's no shipping option. It's just free local pickup.
Hmm. That is kind of right next door, isn't it?
Oh, no. Sorry, Paul. This is the last thing you need, man. Talk about needing space.
Right.
Well, and that's my eBay thing, and I guess that closes us out. So I'm going to do a little round the table here, and I'll start. I have cranked out the first lines of code, so I can say that, you know, the first bytes are actually committed to disk for a Commodore Server chat program that'll run both in Windows 8.1 and also on Windows Phone 8.1. And I want to publish it to the Windows Store. My son and I have been going through a series of videos from Microsoft on how to write apps for Windows 8.1. He's actually written a game app, like a little puzzle game, which was cool for his senior capstone. But I want to write this. There's CommodoreServer.com, which is a location for storing your Commodore disks up in the cloud. And also there are blogs over there of interest for Commodore enthusiasts. And as well, Commodore Server can also be used as a chat hub. People get on their C64s with their internet modems of various flavors, either the the Comet 64 or the Commodore Flyer, and chat by that. But if you don't happen to be sitting on your Commodore at the moment and you want to get in the action on this chat, I want to make a chat client that'll work with that. And it's a pretty simple protocol. It's called the Commodore Server Internet Protocol. It looks a bit like HTTP if you look at it down under the hood. So that's my stuff. That's what I'm working on. Paul, what's going on closing out in your neck of the woods?
I don't know. Not a whole lot more than what I've already talked about. You know, playing around with BASIC, trying to still trying to get some time to work on low level disk imaging, but just continuing on.
Michael?
Well, as I said in my eBay auction, I've just recently picked up a VZ300. It was a fairly complete set, all the pieces in original box and styrofoam. So it's the console itself, two joysticks, 16K RAM memory expander, and most importantly, a data cassette player. So they'll be able to use that on all of my machines that use the cassette tapes for the program input and saving. And it also came with half a dozen cassettes of programs. So it's ready to rock and roll. That one's currently sitting upstairs, waiting for a break in the weather to take it downstairs. That's the downside of my 8-bit bunker. I don't have internal access to the house. Got to go out the back and across the backyard and then back into the bunker. So not a good thing to be taking things down to it when it's raining.
Right. But that sounds like it'll be fun to play with.
I have this picture in my mind of you having to unlock a big door and then pull it up as you walk down the stairs to this dark area that you have for your bunker.
I've actually been looking at where we can do an extension on the house in the future, and including a staircase down to the back of the 8-bit bunker, where it basically is the carved out sandstone, and maybe have that side of the wall of the staircase behind glass, because the water does weep through the sandstone. And I thought it would make it for an interesting sort of feature with some lighting in there. And it would also mean that I'm not sacrificing any space inside the actual 8-bit bunker to the staircase itself.
Definitely.
But that's way down in the future. And importantly, the Apple II Oz Group, we've started planning our next meet, and it looks like it's going to be in Melbourne in April of next year. But once we get venue and dates all nailed down, I'll let you guys and all our listeners know when and where it is.
Excellent. That sounds like fun, too. Very good. And Dr. Steve, it was awesome having you with us today. I'm glad that your schedule permitted you to be on the podcast. So help us land the plane here.
Well, as far as what would we do for landing, I'm afraid I don't have any landing gear out. We might just have to ditch this one. I don't know.
Any landing you can walk away from is a good landing.
Well, I brought a parachute, so I think I'm good. No, I don't have any retro things in my near future. Just primarily working and keeping up with day-to-day life.
Very good. Well, that's important to do. I've got my son's birthday party, actually, that we're having tonight. He's having some friends over. They're going to have a good old-fashioned LAN party, bringing over some PCs, and we're going to hook them all up, and they're going to probably stay up all night gaming, is my guess.
Sounds good.
Yeah, well, excellent. A pleasure as always. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. If you want to discuss this show or any of the other retro podcasts or whatever, there is a forum for that particular topic over at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. The forums over there are wonderful. Get on over and take part. You can follow us on Twitter, although we don't tweet much, but I'm going to try and tweet some more at RCR Podcast. If you've got feedback, we love reading it. So send it to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a proud member of the Throwback Network, where you can find all kinds of retro stuff. If retro is your thing, the Throwback Network, you just don't want to pass go or collect $200. You want to go straight there, throwbacknetwork.net. And if you like the show, please write a review for us on iTunes. So, gentlemen, until next time,
Retro Compute.